Check that it works. Okay, it works, and I'll start recording on this computer here. So we have a double recording there to back up in the case of possible errors. So this is the third session. Let's begin straight away. So the first question is analytical, and the other are computer exercises. So I'll start sharing the green screen. Okay, this is actually, I've already shared you this suggested solution to this first question previously. Previously, it went under the name of sixth question in the demonstration, but now it's a question, question number one. So please open the question sheet again and we'll start going. And additionally, I uploaded the R codes. There were some typos. I didn't. I made few adjustments in the code, but there were some typos, and some things were just set on the. Some things were actually the opposite down the how they really are. So I changed a few typos. So please upload the new R codes again. I uploaded them. That was around 10 o'clock. So if you downloaded your codes after then, you aren't having any problem. But if before, then please re download them. So the first questions we have it's about the identification of the multivariate models. So we have a system of two equations here. U1 and U2, and as we can see from here, there's a endogeneity in these models, in a sense that you can see that when the U1 is the dependent variable, the U2 is included on the right hand side, and it's the same again in another equation where the U2 is the dependent variable, the one is on the right-hand side. So this refers to the endogeneity. So there's an endogeneity in these models, meaning that they're determined simultaneously. So first of all, we'll ask, what are the undesirable consequences that arise in estimating one and two separately using the OLS? So here, take one of the equations, either the first one, and plug it into the second one. So you'll see, or the other way around, take the U2 and plug it there. Then note the coefficient of the variable. So if you think about B1 here, you'll see immediately that the coefficient is here dependent on the error term of the other equation. So, and one of the conditions of the OLS in the strictest possible sense, it's the strict exogeneity, means that the coefficient conditional on the error term is zero. The expectation of the coefficient conditional on the error term is zero. So in this case, we can see that that's not the case. So that means that we are violating the assumptions of the OLS. And this means in the both cases that the covariance between the U1 and the error term is not zero, and this is the violation. B part. So how our answer changes if the variable U1 is not included in the second equation? Okay, so it's not included. So this not included here means that we'll set this term as zero in this second equation, referring that this term is excluded or it vanishes from the equation, mean that we are only estimating U2 by a intercept and one independent variable. So in this case, it's like a normal OLS estimate. So given that we're not violating any other assumptions of the OLS, we can perfectly use the estimator in this case. This says that we would have a triangular system. So a triangular system, this is basically matrix algebra. This is more technical point here, but basically what it means is that I can explain that, but it's not an important thing. If you haven't gone through the matrix algebra in this case, it is just an additional technical note. But the additional technical note is here that you should think these equations as in a matrix form, in a sense that this U1 and U2 are a vector, and then you should think these coefficients and the independent variables as another vector. Actually, let's do that way. I'll try to Google this, and I'll share my Google screen. So I'll share my Google screen so that you can see the technical. What's the technicality behind it? So basically, what we're doing here, this is the lower upper decomposition of factorization of the matrix. But what we're doing here, so here. This isn't the most simple way to represent this. Okay. Yeah, actually, this is good. You'll see the matrix here. This capital A matrix. This is a normal square matrix. So this is our starting point. When we decompose it, so in this case, we exclude another independent variable from the case. So it's either one of these triangular system we're using. So one of these equations would be zero. But in this case, the normal OLS equation is not given. So you can see immediately how the math is going, but yeah, let's quit that one. That's not even that important. It's just a technical note. But here, think just. Let me repeat myself. The main idea is to make the equation such that it OLS can be used. So we might sometimes, or we can use triangular system in case we have violations of the go conditions, and when we do this, we can use the OLS as the estimation method. So that's mainly the important point here. And the C part, state the order condition for determining whether an equation is part of a system, just defined system, and check is this the case with equation one or two. Okay, so order condition. So here we're using this kind of way to express it. So think of G as the number of the structural equation here. So that means the number of indigenous variables. And we have two equations here. And then we are given a condition that one of the equation is just identified or exactly identified if the G minus one variables are absent. So minus one refers here to to the intercept of the equation. So that's one coefficient that has to be taken into account. So on the left hand side we have two equations, and on the right hand side we have two. In the first case, in the first equation, we have two independent variables, and then in the second case, one independent variable. So when we have, if we have one independent variable on the right-hand side, then our system is exactly identified. If we don't have any independent variables on the right-hand side, then our system is over-identified, meaning that there are more equations in the Zeno's equations than the explanation variables. And if we have two or more independent variables on the right-hand side, the x variables I am referring here, then the system is not identified at all. So the main idea of order condition is that you have to have at least as many variables on the left-hand side, meaning the endogenous variables, or more than the independent variables on the right-hand side. So to say it more clearly, let's look at the example here. So in our case, we have two equations, and we should only have one independent variable on the right-hand side. So this condition isn't satisfied in the first case, as we have two independent variables, whereas in the second case, it is justified as we have only one. So to summarize this, this condition is satisfied in the second case, but not in the first case. So that's the answer. So next we can go to the computer exercises. And if you haven't already opened your R, I'll give you a few moments to do that. Just do the same thing as always, that if you can't remember, in order to open the data, click the session tab and then go to choose directory and choose the file, the folder where your data is, and set that as your directory. And then please load the libraries in question. And then we'll can continue on first. So first, so we're making vector out of aggressive estimation, and we're applying this to exchange rate data. And we have three currencies. All of them are measured against the US dollar, euro, British pound, and Japanese yen. And then we're asked to study the lead lag relationships in the return data. And yes, the purpose of this analysis is to answer to the question whether any of these currencies react to news more quickly than the others. And our data range is almost 20 years. So let's start reading the data and calculating the length. Just in case we might need the orders sometimes later on. Then in the first part, let's calculate continuously compounded percentage returns. So that's just the log difference of time values, consecutive time values multiplied by 100. So let's just calculate all of them. And if there are some errors, just run it second time. So and then let's start plotting. So I'll set the plot space as two times two matrix. Sometimes this works and sometimes this doesn't, but let's try. These are the three charts. Okay, so we're able to see all of them. And I'll run that. It won't use the same plot matrix form again. So just by comparing our returns, we see from every series that the volatility, the volatilities are not constant. They're changing over time. Sometimes the volatility is higher and sometimes smaller. This applies to every series. So first of all, we know that the volatility is not constant. There's some volatility clustering, and then there are some periods of more extreme volatility. And from here, from each series here, we can see that this is the September of 2008. So that was the peak of the financial crisis. So understand very much the volatility. So not strong boundaries defined there. September breaks was practical game for stocks around 1.5 euros and it fell to 1.3. Third part. Okay, then we're constructing a bar model. So first of all, some few notes about the refreshed memory on the bar sort of model. So the advances of these models are that due to endogeneity, it is possible to identify all equations, and this allows us to specify the equations in such a way that each of the equation can depend on their own and other lags and the combination of the different error terms. So when we think like in the first exercise, we had this we wanted to use the simplest possibles OLS case. So comparing this way of estimating the model, it's more flexible than the simple OLS estimation method. And one major disadvantage of this model is that it's atheoretical, and this means that we are just using multiple equations and multiple lags, but if we are making that kind of estimation, we are not exactly sure what we are estimating. So usually these VAR models are run as a structural VAR models, and this means that we're specifying further restrictions and constraints into these models, and this puts some further structures in this system of equations so that there's it would correspond to better economic intuition. So if we are just using VAR estimations, doing this multivariate estimations, and we have a significant lags, it could be well the case that even though the coefficients are statistically significant, if there's no any economic intuition or theory behind, it could well be the case that these relationships are in a deeper sense spurious. So let's start constructing our matrix. And here the important thing in this matrix is the order, how we order of these variables in this function. So when we're specifying this function this way, we're assuming that there's more exogeneity in the euro returns than in the British pound or in the Japanese yen. And this could be justified in that way that, if I remember correctly, in a foreign exchange market, around 50%, or was it 44% of the total is the trading of the euro US dollar exchange rate. So that's the most active one, and then it's It's probably the British pound that's the second important currency, and Japanese yen comes after that. Yeah, the British pound, it can be well due to role of the London city in the financial markets. It's a really important financial place. So, and historically, that means after the Second World War, the London has had a really special place in the global financial market. So it's well the case. It could be well the case that the pound is the second most traded currency. And then there's a yen, Japanese yen. Then there are some other currencies like Switzerland's franc. It's important. And one of the rising currencies as of last decade was the China's renminbi. But I believe it's internationalization of the renminbi has decreased like last 5 years, if I remember correctly. That. But the ordering of the VAR matrix is important because it's we're emphasizing there the exogeneity. So first we are asked to use two lags. So let's specify that and check the results. Okay, there's something. Okay, I didn't run that. So here's the data and then let's run the results. So we have two lags here and let's see what's happening. Okay, so from the results and some statistics we'll see here, we are estimating this is the part of the euro returns in the series, and we'll see that first of these coefficients are like one coefficients are usually statistically significant, but the other are not. And then in the second row of our dependent variable is the British pound, and we'll see returns of it, and we'll see that only Japan, there's only one lag that has a significance. And then the third row is yen returns, and yeah, there's only its own lag is significant in this. But in each of these cases, we'll see that second lag is never significant. So this begs a question that would one lag be enough? So next, Let's run a multiple criteria, and this is D part in this question of fourth part. So let's run the information criteria and see what they say. And here the selection is given. Here we have given four criteria, four different information criteria, and every one of them says that lag number one is the optimal. And if you compare this value to the other values, you see that this value is it is higher than the other values. So yeah, so higher the information criteria, the better the modeling fit. And we are using here the Akai criteria and the Schwarz criteria and these two other criteria, Hannah Quicking, and then there's this one I can't remember what it was. So then let's run our. Let's run the VAR model with one lag. And let's run this both summary statistics so that we can compare them. So in the first case, you'll remember that there were only first lags were significant, but the second lag was never significant, neither of the cases. So then let's check some values up. So that let's keep these values in our mind. So it's like the first case is like almost minus 1.10 and the other is 180 and 104. So let's check that they're about the same. Yeah, so we'll see again that this same lags in one lag model are significant and the values are about, the estimates are about the same. So that's a good sign. We want to have the as robust estimates as possible. So if we exclude or throw the second leg away, our result don't seem to change that much. So in seconds, in rebound, it's those are the values to keep in mind. Yeah, they're almost the same. In the case of yen, it is those values minus 0.04, 0.04 and significant. And here it's almost the same value. So it seems to be the case that if we throw one leg away, we are not losing much. But because just by eyeballing the results is not enough, and we want to justify our choice by statistical inference, so let's test this by doing a likelihood ratio test. Okay. No, actually, here we actually asked to use one or four legs. So basically, the follow-up here was that we can use information criteria set that first one leg is better than two legs. So that's one of the, and then we checked the results, and it seemed to be the case that we're really not using that much. So let's take the first optimal, assume that the optimal leg is one, and then let's compare this model with the var equation with the four legs and see how the results differ. Okay, here we are running exactly the same equations above. Only difference is here that the type constant has been specified, but it's the default setting. So this equation is the same as this equation above. So let's calculate the likelihood values then. Of course, we have to run the equation for, and then let's calculate likelihood values. And then let's do the same thing for the model with four legs. Calculate likelihood values. So just by eyeballing the likelihood functions, we'll see that. We'll see that model with one leg has a small log likelihood function, and when we are basing our comparison of the better the fit condition on likelihood function criteria is that smaller the likelihood value, the better the fit. So as this value in the model that has only one leg is smaller than the one that has four legs, it'll according to this criteria, this one leg model is better than the four leg model. Then let's check how our results change if we just look individual equations. So here let's look just the Euro series, the one leg model, and compare it with the four leg model. So these are the same results as earlier. Keep these values in mind. All coefficients statistically significant and estimates are here. Then let's check the four leg model, and we will see that the estimates are the same and the same and the same, and each of them is statistically significant. And there seems to be not much to add a lag. So this will also support choosing one lag over four lags. So then the bridge is bound. Just comparing these results, this is the one leg equation, and here we have a four leg equation. We'll see that the values are about the same. And if we add, and this same leg is also statistically significant, and if we add other legs, there doesn't seem much to be add on. And lastly, the Japanese yen. With one leg and with four legs, we see again from this four leg model that the first leg is about the values are about the same, that and the result don't change. And the other lags seem to be not so important. But like I said earlier, just by eyeballing the model is not enough, and we want to base our choice doing research in statistical inference. So let's run the likelihood ratio test. So this is our test statistic. So first of all, our null hypothesis is that there is no difference between the models. The difference between these models is zero, and in this case, the restricted model is as good as the unrestricted model. So that's the null. And then we calculated here secondly our test statistic, and it's a little bit over 30. And then we'll thirdly compare it with the value of the probability distribution. It seems to be the case that the value is much lower than the critical limit imposed by the value of the probability distribution. So in this case, the null stays in power, and it refers to the case that the restricted model works as good as the unrestricted model. So to say it another way, we can throw the additional slack away because they don't seem to add that much. So VAR1 is a good enough model to continue on. And then the sixth and seventh part. So lastly, we're doing impulse responses and variance decomposition. So first of all, impulse responses is a graphical representation of accumulated responses of how a shock that at the period T affects to some variable same period or a little bit further on. And this variable X can be any variable in question, either the same variable in the series or some other variables. And usually it is the case that when we look at the impulse responses, this series decays to zero. And why this is so, and this is due to stationarity. And if the stationarity doesn't hold, it could be the case that we have mystified our model and we're missing some structural change in the model. So let's perform these impulse responses to each of these series. So just a few notes about this function, impulse response function. First, we'll specify the matrix we want to do this analysis, and then we'll specify the series in that matrix that where the shock arrives, and then we specify the responses and then the length we want to look at. So for example, if this 10 days here refers to the two weeks period, so this means that when for example some negative news arrives this day, 10 days, the day number 10 is 10 days after how, for example, in the case of stock performance, how this negative news would affect the returns of the series. And let's skip these other notes there, because those first one are the most important ones, and let's look at the responses. Okay, so this is these are impulse responses, and when we are shocking some parameter, and in the first case, we are shocking the returns of the euro US dollar series. So this is the value of the one standard deviation shock, so it seems to be around 1.6. We can check that one fairly easily. So just comparing this value to the one where the chart begins. This is the size of our shock. We're shocking our euro return series, and we'll see immediately that when such size a shock happens in the euro series, that's the effect. And at the next lap, it goes almost to zero, meaning that shock is most has most impact at the same period, but then afterwards it decreases really quickly to zero. And after a few periods, it vanishes. This means that when the euro, when there's some like the negative macroeconomic news in the euro, USD dollar series, it also affects negatively to the British pound. So at the same, if the size of the shock is 0.6, the British pound reacts like 0.3. So it helps us. This is done because there's some impact on the Japanese yen. Secondly, let's check the reactions to pound USD dollar series. So again, we're shocking now the British pound, and size of the shock is about the same as before. They have a really, really nicely correlating standard deviation of this series. It's about the same. So when there's negative shock in the British pound at the period, at the present day, it seems to be the case that the euro series, euro US dollar series, is not reacting at the same day, but with a one length lag. So when something like when the Brexit happens, it hits the most use the British pound US dollar series, and the next day the US dollar euro series seems correct, and then the effect on Japanese yen is almost minimal. This is interesting. Why doesn't Japanese yen react at all? And one of the possibilities could be the case that Japan has had zero lower bound or negative rates since the beginning of the 90s. So basically, that means that Japanese government's bond has produced only minimal yields after like 30 years already. So one of the possibilities could be the case that Japan doesn't react strongly is that there's not much connection between the Japanese yen and the yen and the Japanese government, for example, government interest rates. And yours is, we're running, our analysis takes into account from the beginning of the 2000. So this includes the time before the great financial crisis and the euro crisis. So after which the rates have been on the zero lower bound in the euro area. So there are actually, you could say that in that way, that there's two different periods included in the euro series. One where the government bonds rated more normally, and after this both crisis, after which the interest rates have been on a zero lower bound and have not bounded back upwards. And lastly, something and then we're doing the decomposition process. What this decomposition does is that it represents how much the case ahead forecast errors of the variables are explained by the information setting the error terms to each explanatory variable. So the numbers that we'll begin are proportional to the impact of U. So I'll show the numbers, so it's going to be that way. Here we are looking at 10 days, that means 2 weeks. So here in the first case, the highlighted area, this is the here we decompose the effect on the euro return series. So in this case, when you look at each rows, you can sum up them up to one. So this is the proportionality that's in question. So when there's a shock in the euro returns at the same period, one day ahead, if we go one day ahead, it'll only affect the returns of the euro series, but afterwards the proportional impact starts to decrease and it is transmitted relatively into another series. So this doesn't tell us what's the size of the impact. It only decomposes the impact, whatever the size it is, into different parts. And afterwards, we see that after a few periods, 4 days, the impact starts to be the same. That the the impact starts is the same. It doesn't change. It doesn't change anymore. So on the second day, there's some impact on the British pound, not so much, 2.5%. That's not so much. And in the Japanese yen is almost non-existent. Then in our bound series, when there's a shock in the bound series, 1 year ahead forecast is that 3/4 of the total shock stays in British pound and 1/4 goes in the euro return series. And this over time, over a period of 10 days, this will be around the same. After a few days, it'll start to be constant. And here, so 1/4 of the shock is transmitted into another currency. That's a high number. So usually this number is not so high. Then the Japanese yen. This is a better, more like usual case it is. So here is 1/4 and here it's almost 95%. So 95% stays in the Japanese yen and 5% is federal. So this is just an additional check of the robustness of these results during the sensitivity analysis. But at the beginning, I tried to emphasize the ordering of the bar matrix, and that was the order about the exogeneity in this matrix structure. And here we specified the euro returns to be the most important currency. So what we'll do next is we'll change the structure of this matrix and see how our results change. So this is the sensitivity analysis. So here we have switched the place of the British pound to the euro returns. And let's run VAR LAC1 model. Let's quickly check the results here. So this is the reaction to the euro US dollar return series. So here again, we have a shock size, similar size as before. We see that when we are shocking the second part of second equation of our matrix, it'll affect euro returns there, but then the effect will diminish over time. So to compare it into this first case, this is exactly a little bit different. When I next print the case earlier, you should see some effect in the British pound. Yeah, here, this is the first one. Here the euro series, their first row and the British pound is the second row. And in this case, so that again, when we switch the first two rows here, it'll be a little different. So why is this the case? Now we're shocking the row second in the order, meaning that in the ordering, we go directly in the ordering to the second row. So we are skipping the first row. But more important case is here, the British pound returns, if there's a connection with the first case. So now we're showing first series in question, and we'll see there's about a similar size. It's most probably the same size of standard deviations as before. And when there's a shock in British pound returns, there's transmission in the euro series. And when we look the earlier case here, we should see the similar results. So that means the first series, so in this same case, we're shocking, we're setting British pound to be the most important currency, and we're shocking it. We're seeing immediately there's an immediate effect in the British in the euro series. So here we're changing their place, and we see about the same change. So here we are shocking the euro series, and we see an immediate effect in the British pound series. So compare So when we have changed the order of the ordering, meaning the importance of the exogeneity, we see that these both currencies are affecting each other. So this result suggests that there's connection between British pound and the Euro series, and that could be due to geography. These areas are geographically close to each other. So if we think that this is the reason that it is the real economies of the England and the Europe are interrelated, we could start analyzing how these both currencies are reacting to the macroeconomic data and how these effects are transmitted into other currencies. And then lastly, we'll look at the Japanese Zen series, and there shouldn't be anything. So it's like before. And then the Cholesky decomposition of the sensitivity analysis, and let's check the results here. So this, when we change the number of the British returns of the British pound in the Euro series, they are most probably like to say, visually they seem to be the same, although there's some minor differences. And here, with respect to exogeneity, so in the first case, here we had the returns of the Euro series, and these numbers were almost the same as here. So to summarize this exercise, so the ordering, so what we did here, we studied, we only used lakhs of the different returns and studied exogeneity between the currencies, the returns. And one of the possibilities is that the Brexit doesn't affect return, but it will most probably affect also the other euro area. So these were the results we got from here. So this is like a starting point of the real analysis. We look at the data and found something that could be the place. But if we want to check the robustness of these results, then we would have to start in deeper. Then the third exercise. So let's begin this one and see how far we are getting, or we will have a break.
Before we go for this exercise, let me go briefly through this data code for the question two.
Yep. Yes.
Hope you can see my screen now. So instead here, we also like start by importing the data set and by specifying first row, where the current state to use the first row of Excel as the name of the variables. And then we're generating the time variable to declare that the data set that we are going to work with is actually time series data set. Then we calculate the returns for Euro, British Pound, Japanese Yen. And here we drop the first missing value for the Euro, but actually it will drop the first value for the all the return series. And here we're plotting the Euro returns. Yep, and here is a graph. The x-axis here looks a bit crowded, but you can always edit it through this graph editor. Yeah, you can always like click on it right click on the axis, and then you have a lot of options here how you can edit it. And then back to the code. Why? Okay, maybe we should close the graph. Yep, and here are the graphs for British pound and Japanese yen. And then we can estimate var here just by typing var, and then the variables we're going to use for the var analysis, so the three return series. And then if you want to use two lags, then you have to type it like that, lags, and then in the parentheses, 1 to 2 lags. Let's do it. And here how the output looks in data. So here the information criteria is for the whole model, and here the equation estimates for each equation. And then here it's also possible to select the optimal var lag lengths. Yeah, and that's how the table looks like here. So here the one lag is considered to be enough for the system. Yep. And then we're here also estimating the var model with one lag, and then comparing the system with one lag with the system with four lags, and performing the likelihood ratio test. Let's run it. Yep. And here we can see that based on the this probability of likelihood ratio test, we can say that the restricted model performs better than unrestricted one. And here also we can get the inverse response functions. First we have to again estimate the model with the number of lags we want to use. And we have to specify the place where we want to store the inverse response functions values. And then there is also an option of order. So if you want to do the sensitivity analysis, you just have to switch the Euro and British pound series expresses here. So let's run the impulse responses graph. Yeah, and here it is. So here you can see all the 9 graphs all together. And the first line shows us that we're shocking the euro returns, and then here is the responses in euro returns, and here the British pound and the Japanese yen. And then we're shocking the returns for the Japanese yen, and the results are exactly the same as in R. Yep, and here also we can do the variance decomposition analysis. Let's run this line. Yeah, and here I want to comment a little bit on it because it looks like the table is organized in a little bit different way, unlike in R. And here to understand what this means, we should go to this place. And from here, we can see that the first table is giving us the variance decomposition when the impulses come in from Euro return series and the response is Euro return series. So yeah, here's the first table. And also instead we can see the lower and upper bounds for the estimated variances. So here, if you summarize the values of first table, and then fourth table and seventh table, then you are also getting one. Just that it's organized in a little bit different order. So yeah, in this way, the arts outputs, they're more organized and they have relative advantage in this. So here, Juha, you can continue now. Thank you.
Yes, thanks. I'm just thinking about whether we should have a break here. So
yep.
The third and fourth exercises are rather long. So for the sake of the fourth argument, it'd be better we go them through.
Yeah.
Both. So let's have a 15 minute break in this today from here on, and let's continue quarter to two.
Okay.
Okay, let's continue. So the third exercise is applying VAR model to interest rate data. So first of all, we are calculating the spread difference between the 10-year US government bond and 3-month bond. And in term structure of interest rates, this is the slope of the yield curve, the difference between the long and short rates. And in addition, we're bringing here the EPU variable that's US Economic Policy Uncertainty Index and see how it is related to term structure of interest rate. So let's get us going. So first of all, let's clear our global environment and load the libraries needed. And then our data is uploaded and the number of the rows needed. So then let's calculate the spread. We need the difference between the long and short rates. That's that. And then we'll transform our series to time series ranging from 91 to the end of 2021. Yeah, it means the beginning of this year, end of the last year, yes. And then we'll transform the EPU series. We take the... We'll take the log of EPUs and multiply it by 100 and then take the series of... Then take the difference of the time consecutive time periods. We'll take that and then we'll make the changes as a time series. So let's start by plotting the series. Okay, let's begin with the EPU series. So from this series, we see how the this is an indicator for uncertainty. That's one way to measure uncertainty in the economy. So there are a lot of different periods in this series. First of all, let's block the August 2007, and that's the starting point of the great financial crisis. So August 2007 is the start point, and the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy September 2008 is the peak point of the development or the evolution of the great financial crisis. So here we have a starting point. Before it, we can see that in general, the uncertainty has been increasing in the economy. So it increased a little bit beginning 2000, and that's due to the dot-com. So that's a more volatile period, but overall, the uncertainty has decreased until the beginning of the great financial crisis. And then we see a more volatile period there, and let's block another straight line into the series, and this is the July 2002. And this was the day when Mario Draghi, the previous president of the European Central Bank, gave his famous speech, "Whatever it takes." So about until that point, the volatility increased in the financial markets. And then when sometime after this speech was given, the volatility started to decrease again. Then we'll see that the volatility or uncertainty decreases a little bit, but overall level is higher than during the period before the Great Financial Crisis. And actually this period before the beginning of the Great Financial Crisis is called the so-called Great Moderation. And this was an era when everyone believed that volatility was overall decreasing and inflation was decreasing, and the financial thought that central banks had everything under their control. So it was one. So the most important aspect of this era is the stability. Everyone thought that the markets were stable, but then after the financial crisis, this assumption was questioned. So after the financial crisis, in general, the volatility has been increasing again. And then let's look what has happened after the January last month, and the 30th of the January was the day when the World Health Organization declared the corona crisis as a global threat or global concern. And we'll see again that the volatility increased. And uncertainty has increased even more higher than earlier. Then let's add 10-year rates here. Or this is actually just the 10-year, how the interest rates, long-term interest rates have been developing since the beginning of the 90s. And overall, we see that the long-term interest rates have been decreasing. And this is the US long-term interest rates. And the same phenomenon is global, that long-term interest rates have been decreasing since the beginning. So the 10-year rate has been decreasing. And then we'll see at the same time the spread between the 10-year bond and 3-month bond. We'll see its behavior. Here, we'll see that there is no excuse. I better draw another line there when we are looking at the spread. So this is the spread at the zero line. And when the spread goes below the zero, it means that, in other words said, it becomes negative. That means that markets are pricing the short, paying higher from the short-term interest rates than the long-term interest rates. So sometimes the yield curve inverts. We'll see here, for example, from 2002 till 2005, this has been a little bit higher. And this was the period when the Greenspan, who was Fed chairman from, 87 till 2006, he put the Fed's effective rates to 1 or 2%, and a lower rate was low proportional to the higher rate. So spread is of course then higher. And then when spread is decreasing and decreasing here, this is the period when Fed is increasing its effective rates, or a general increase in the lower rate, when spread is becoming smaller and smaller. And here we can see from around 2010, we'll see that the spread between the long and short is effectively zero. They are the same, and this is a zero lower bound period in Fed's history. And that was around 2000, November 2008 till December 2015. And then then from here on, we see that Fed has again begun to increase its short-term interest rate. And this means at the same time that 3-month government bond yield correlates really closely with the Fed's effective rate. So then let's plot the EBU index on another axis. Just by eyeballing the series, we'll see that the EBU index its movements correlate really closely with the spread of the interest rates. And that this relationship holds until 2008, and afterwards it has been a little bit more different. So here, with the Fed had its rates at the zero lower bound, the spread was actually higher, and then there was a short period. Then there was some period it held again, but then the interrelationship broke again. And so for sure, afterwards, it has been a little bit more complicated. So let's plot some lines here. So the breakup here correlates around, emerges after the Lehman bankruptcy, and then it starts to decrease again in May 2013. And May 2013 is a period when Fed announced its tapering. So between these dates, Fed was effectively buying government bonds and mortgage bonds from the market, and in May 2013, it was tapering its quantitative easing program. And now after the corona crisis, Fed is now also buying or printing money, so to say, again, really, really extensively. Then let's look at the three months and the EBO index, how they're behaving. 3 months spread and EPU. So it'll look like this. Again, we'll see that the EPU is correlating quite closely with the spread, and not with any singular rate. Although from here on, we'll see that there's some negative relationship between the. So when the fixed rate is here higher, the EPU rate seems to be getting behaving inversely, and then the other way around, when the 3 month rate is getting lower, EPU is increasing. So this would suggest that there's some inverse correlation between the series. But after September 2008, it seems to break. One of the possibilities here would be to. Because the zero rate bounds the 3 month interest rate. In the case of US and Europe, it is not the case. In Europe, we have had the negative rates almost seven years soon. So in Europe, it is something different. But in the case here, one of the possibilities could be to instead of plotting 3 month government bond, try shadow rate. That's a mathematical construct. Wu and Xie was the article 2015 or 16. You can check sometimes what the shadow rate is about. But then let's get our estimations going. So first, let's create two VAR models. In the first case, we have three variables. So, and then the second, the first model is about levels, and the second, where we have two variables, it is about changes. So let's run them, and then let's start estimating our models. So first, let's estimate the free model VAR and check the results. So we're using here 12 lakhs. Just by eyeballing these equations, this is the first row. We'll see that there are a lot of lakhs to be estimated, and there doesn't seem to be much significance over there. Only few lakhs are significant. This is our second row. The DPL we're estimating with lakhs of all three different variables. There seems to be some significance, not so much. Rather there seems to be lots of unnecessary stuff. And then our third equation, third row, that's the EBU, level of the EBU, and only some lakhs seems to be statistically significant. So then let's do the same thing for the changes for the two variable model and check the results. In this case, we don't have to indirect the estimates or compare them, because our perspective is different than before. Here we are talking about returns and earlier about levels. We see something, there's some significance, not so much. And then some in the second row, some significance. Yeah, here we had only two equations. But overall, there seems to be a lot of unnecessary stuff in our model. So next, let's calculate the log likelihood functions and see what they are saying. So this is the first one. And then let's print it. This is the value of the three variable model and the value of the two variable model. In the case of the log likelihood, the higher the value, the better the fit. So in this case, this would suggest that the three variable model is the better guess just by comparing log likelihood functions. But then let's run some information criteria to back up our choice. So first, let's specify the needed criteria there, and then run the log likelihood, then compare the multivariate Akaike information criteria. Here, when we compare these values, we'll see that two variable model has the smaller information criteria, and the information criteria there, the relevance is the opposite than in the log likelihood function, meaning that smaller the information criteria, better the fit. Yeah, that's the definition of information criteria. So yeah, that's so although it says here that log likelihood, the interpretation is a little bit different earlier. And then let's check. So the multivariate Akaike says the two variable case is the better. And then let's check what the Schwarz multivariate criteria says. And again, smaller the value by comparing these two values, smaller the value, the better. So Schwarz would also suggest that two variable case is the better. So here we have a little bit mixed result. The log likelihood function said the three variable case is better, but the information criteria said that the two variable case. So let's then look something else and use a little bit lower amount of lags in our model. So here we are doing the same stuff only with six lags. So here, first we're estimating our models, and then let's check the information criteria. So in the first case, we're running, this is the optimal information criteria for the three-lag model, three-variable model. And the optimization method says that in the case of Akaike, the optimal lag is 6, but in this case of Schwarz, it is 2. And then let's check the same information in a three-variable case, and there Akaike says it is 7, which is 1. So here we could exactly continue this analysis with the both models, but the important thing to note here or to remember here is what we want to research on. And next we will continue only with the three variable case, and this is due to our interest in a long run relationships between the variables. So when we're analyzing levels, we're interested more in the long-run behavior. But if we are analyzing the changes, we're more interested in the short-run behavior of the series. And we just assume that our series are stationary. It could be the case that this series, all of the series, are not stationary. But here, we assume that the series are stationary. So in a research-wise, this means that we're just assuming something and checking where this assumption lead us. But when we assume something, this doesn't necessarily imply that that's the truth of the case. Sometimes we could make in a sense a wrong assumption or false or unreal assumption, in a sense that we assume that something is not important for our research. So this assumption just simplifies our analysis and brings something forth if there is something it would be bring forth. So, and why we are concentrating on the levels, one of the reasons for this is that when we are differentiating the series, we are losing some information in that series. This is to say, in another way, that levels and changes are not the same thing. And when we transform a series, we lose some information, but this also, although this brings something other information in force. So then let's run the log likelihood ratio test. And here we are testing the 12 lakh model against 6 lakhs. And this 6 lakhs was given from the multivariate information criteria, from the Akaiga information criteria. And our hypothesis is that there is no difference between the unstructured and the restricted model. So let's check the case. Let's calculate likelihood. Okay, let's begin just by eyeballing this series. This long series with 12 lakhs, and then the long series with 6 lakhs. So this is the first case. Here we are using 6 lakhs, and we see that there's some significance over there, but not so much. And when lack is, the significance also starts to vanish. And this is our 12 lakh model. Oh, not that one. This is our 12 lakh model. We see that the same variables are significant here as before, and then after that number, it doesn't seem to be much. And for the sake of the time, I'll skip eyeballing these other two series because these results are about the same. So then let's run our likelihood ratio test. So test the difference between the logs. So our null is no difference. And this is our test statistics, and then we'll compare it with the probability distribution. The value is lower than the value of the probability distribution, meaning that the null stays in power, meaning that there is no difference. So when there is no difference, the restricted model performs as good as the unrestricted model, meaning that we can throw the unnecessary lags away without losing much, or without losing anything. And then in the next part, we're testing this. We are doing the same thing, comparing the 6 lakhs against 1 lakh. Here, it'd be a little bit better if we use the 2 lakhs, because that's the Schwarz criteria that Schwarz criteria gave us. So basically, the idea is here to compare 6 Akaiga lakhs against the Schwarz lakhs and test which one of them performs better. But here we can, just for sake of argument, assume that there's not so much difference with the 1 lakh and the 2 lakh. So here, implicitly assuming the parsimony, we throw 1 lakh away and test here directly whether there's any change if we try 6 lakhs against 1 lakh. So let's estimate the model. And then we could eyeball the, but we have already done that enough. So let's calculate the likelihood function and do the statistical test. So the null hypothesis is no difference. This is our test statistics and the value of the probability distribution. We see that this value 2008 exceeds 75 quite nicely, meaning that we reject the null, and there is a difference. So when the log difference deviates from the zero, it is the case that restriction decreases the goodness of the fit, and in this case, the unrestricted model performs better. And here, our unrestricted model is the VAR1 model. this doesn't necessarily mean that this is some kind of that in that our test is some kind of holy book that we base everything our assumptions. Rather, it is about what we want to study. So it could be still be the case that 12 like model performs in some research questions better than one like model, and this can be to the case that it can take decision analysis better into account. So it's about perspective we want to study on or analyze. And then let's start comparing. Yeah, next let's calculate multivariate information criteria. So that was the likelihood ratio test set. Likelihood ratio test said that the VAR1 model is the modeling case. Then let's calculate the multivariate. For the six multivariate information criteria for the 6 lakhs, and those are the values. I have to print them again because it'll be easier to compare them. So first of all, this is the information criteria for the information criteria for 6 lakhs, and this is for the 1 lakh, and as the information value is lower, this would suggest that the 1 lakh model performs better, is more optimal than the 6 lakh model. And then let's look the same thing with the Schwarz criteria multivariate case, 6 lakhs and then 1 lakhs, and the value is lower again. Here is some, I don't know why I'm talking about the likelihood function here, log likelihood function, because it's about information criteria, not the log likelihood function. But in both cases, the information criteria of the smaller lakh model seems to be the model of, well, we want to continue on. And then we can compare these values with the 12 lakhs models. In the both cases, if we look at this 12 lakh value here, is even higher than the 6 lakh value. It's higher than 6 lakh value and the 1 lakh value. So the 12 lakh model seems to be the first model here. And the same applies with the Schwarz criteria. The value of the 12 lakh performs worst, gives us the first fit. And then let's go to the question number 4. It's about the Krenger causality and the impulse responses for macro variables. So we're using the same data, but we're calculating a new subsample, and we're testing about a Krenger causality between these variables. And the Krenger causality is about the lacks of the some other variables useful in forecasting the present values of some other variables. So it's not the causality in the natural science sense. It's rather a weaker sort of causality we're talking about here. Something happens before in time, and if something happens before, whether this change is helpful in forecasting what will happen one period after in some other variable. It doesn't give us directly what's the driving force here behind, but it is still more, if the result is significant, it is still more stronger result than the normal time series regression that says that something just vaguely explains something. So first, let's set our subsamples. First one is here for the levels, subset for the levels, and subset for changes, and then subsets for the long-term interest rate and the short-term interest rates. And then we'll start to studying to Krenger causality with levels of EPU and short-term interest rates, T-bonds here. T-bonds, that's actually long-term interest rates. Bills are the short-term interest rates, bonds are the longer term. So first, this is our matrix. We bind the two vectors. Then we run the estimation. This is actually, we check the information criteria. According to Akaike criteria, 4 is the luck and Smart says it's 2. So let's test both of them. What's the result? So here we are, let's first estimate the model. This is the model for the with 4 lakhs, and then let's start to test the Kranger causality. Kranger causality here, so this prints everything needed. So this time R specifies our null hypothesis. So here the null hypothesis is that the in the subs in our subsamples, the long-term interest rates are not helpful in forecasting the change in the EPU. So that's our null. And then this is our test statistic. So Kranger causality is basically like a test. This is our test stat, and here's our p-value when we've compared it with the probability distribution, and we see that we reject the null. And this means that longer-term interest rates in our subsample are useful in forecasting the uncertainty in the economy. And then let's run the similar test with 2 lakh model and test the causality. And we have a similar result. Very much below the critical 0.05, meaning that the null doesn't stay in power. We reject it. So lacks of the long-term interest rates are useful for forecasting the uncertainty in the economy. And then let's do the same test for the changes in the EPU. So that's previously we got the long run result, and next we are interested in short run. So first we specify our variables in interest, combine them, then run the information criteria. And according to info criteria, 4 and 2 are the optimal lakhs. So let's start again testing with 4 lakhs. What does it say? First we estimated our matrices, our model, and then in the secondly we test the causality, the Kranger causality. And null again is no effect. Long run rates are not useful or do not Kranger cause the changes in the EPU index. And we have a fairly high test statistic and our p-value is pretty low. So here we see again that longer run rates are useful in forecasting the changes in uncertainty of the economy. And then the same for 2 lakh model. And again, just by looking at the p-value, we reject the null and see that they are useful in forecasting the changes. So earlier we studied the Kranger causality of the long run rates and the EPU, and next let's look at the short run rates. This is our matrix. Let's check the info criteria. And I say that it's 12 and Smart says it's 3. So let's use also both of them. First, in the case of 12 lakhs, test the Kranger causality. And the null is no Kranger effect or Kranger cause. So then we'll look at the p-value and we'll see that the null stays in power. So this means that the P rates in a subsample are not useful in predicting the changes in economic uncertainty. And then we'll check the same thing with 3 lakhs. And the result is the same. So neither reject the null. We can start here thinking about why is this the case that the 3-month interest rates are not useful in forecasting. So one of the possibilities here that zero lower bound, and now look here, this plot, zero lower bound is affecting in such a way that the forecasting ability vanishes. So what we do, one of the possibilities to do here is to divide the subsample even further, and like before and after September 2008, and study whether the results are the same or they change. That's something that could be done. And then other way of studying this is to use the shadow rate. It's shadow rate that I referred earlier, and here's actually the article is all. So Wu and Chia, 2016. So instead of T-bells, try applying shadow rates and see what's happening there. And next, we are checking the next impulse responses and Solesky decomposition. So this is some additional analysis here. But yeah, I'll speed up something, we can do them. So first, let's check the impulse responses of the three lags. And here we are, here we have changes of the uncertainty index and long-term interest rates. So that's our matrix. Let's estimate that with three lags and check the impulse responses. So now it looks a little bit messy. Here the shock happens in the uncertainty, and the series above this is how the same series behaves after the shock. So we see that when there's 1.1 standard deviation shock in the series, next it'll go in the negative territory in the next period. When there's a huge increase in uncertainty, in the next month, it's uncertainty usually decreases a little bit, and then it starts to decrease again before it converges to zero. At the same time, it has no impact on the long-term rates. And next, let's check how the responses are with the long-term yield. When there's a shock in long-term yield, next period, it affects negatively, and then it starts to converge to zero. And the effect on the uncertainty index is actually that's the double one. So sorry, I messed that up. So I'll say it again. We have a shock in long-term rates, and this above is the uncertainty. When there's a shock in interest rate, next period, the uncertainty decreases a little bit before it starts to converge to zero. And this graph below is how it affects the long-term rates. And when the shock happens, the effect will be quite minimal afterwards. Then let's check the decomposition. So shock in uncertainty in changes in uncertainty index. First, in uncertainty, it starts to be transmitted to the long-term behavior of the long-term rates, and then afterwards, second case, shock happens in the long-term interest rates. It'll mostly stay there, but some effects are transmitted immediately into the changes of the uncertainty. But overall, the effect is proportionally not that high. Yes, and then we're actually in the D part. Yeah, we are running here another subsample. So first, let's calculate the subsamples, and let's then do the tests. So first of all, this is our matrix. We have two variables there, EPU, subsample 2, and interest rate, subsample 2. Then let's check the information criteria. And according to the Mulder et al., the optimal lag is 5, and optimal SWOT criteria says that it's two. So let's use both of them and test the chronology. First with 5 lakhs. Remember the null Granger course, meaning here that long-term rates in our second subsample are not useful in forecasting the uncertainty economy. When we look at the value, we'll see that it will stay in power at a level of 5%. It isn't as strong result as the case that the value be below 0.01, but there's still some. It isn't strongly significant, but it is significant. So significant at the level of 5, and with 2 lakhs, also significant at the level of 5. So in both cases, long-term rates are useful in forecasting the uncertainty in the economy. And then let's do the same thing. Then we are interested in asking, do the debond rates Granger cause the changes in EPU, so short run behavior. Specify our subsamples. This is our matrix. Let's check the information criteria. And according to multivariate information criteria, Akaike says it's 4 and SMART says it's 2. Then let's estimate our model and test the Granger causality. And we'll see that in this case, in our second subsample, long run rates are useful in predicting forecasting the changes in the EPU index. And then with 2 lakhs, again, similar result. So in both cases, normalization power at the significance level of 5, but these results, as in both cases, the p-value is over 0.01, although below 0.05, it is strongly statistically significant. And then let's do the same analysis for the t-bills. Our matrix, and let's check the information criteria. So 4 and 3 lakhs. First, with 4 lakhs, the null stays in power. So the TPL of the TPL rates of the second subsample are not useful in forecasting the changes in the EPU index. No short run forecasting ability. And then with 3 lakhs, and the result is the same. So T-bills are not, like earlier, they're not useful in predicting or in forecasting the changes in EPU index. So next, let's check the impulse responses. That's first we bind our, form our matrix, then we'll run the, then we'll estimate the matrix, and then let's check. So here we have a shock in the changes of the EPU in the second subsamples and their day effect. And they have effect on the changes of the EPU index. Shock happens next period, the effect is inverted and then it starts to convert. But also effect in the long run rates. And then let's check the other plot. Now the shock happens in the long-term rates. And the next period, the effect in the EPU, changes of the EPU is negative, and then it starts to convert back to zero. And almost no effect in the behavior of the long run rates. And then after the impulse responses, the Solesky decomposition, the proportionality of the effects, meaning here that in the first row, in each of these rows, we have normalized effect. The effect is always one without it. And when we normalize it, we ignore the size of the effect. So it's about proportionality, how this one although we don't know its real effect, how this is proportionally divided into these two series. So shock in EPU, next period all about changes in EPU, and then some transmission happen. Secondly, shock in long-term interest rates. Even at the period one, some really, really, really minor effect in EPU, and afterwards it starts to increase a little bit, although proportionally 1.5% is not high. So this was our second, fourth exercise, and then we have two more to go, and they're quicker than the ones earlier. So next, question number five. So first,
could I add something before we go to the question? Sure. Just a little bit about Ringer causality test. So in state there, the output of Ringer causality looks like this, and things that this first line means that the null hypothesis is that the T-bond rate does not Ringer cause the levels of EPU, and the second row means that if we had more than two variables in the system, that would mean that T-bond rate and another variable do not Ringer cause the levels of EPU. But since we have only two variables in the system, this means that the statistics are here are the same. And the third line, the null hypothesis for the third line is that the levels of the EPU index do not range across the T-bond rate. And same here is that if we had more than two variables in the system, all those except the levels of EPU do not range across the T-bond rate. Yeah, that's the only difference with R I can mention. So yeah, you can continue.
So then to question number five. So next we start to dig on unit roots. Yes, unit roots. Let me share my R screen. So first I clear the global environment, and then let's load the libraries needed and the data. So here, earlier we were using log values, but now after some few changes that we're only applying the raw data without transforming it. So I've still left these logs here just in the case that if someone wants to run there on their own. Usually we can use the log transformation, although the log transformation loses some information in the series, it is still useful measure in the series. The basics of the log transformation is that it transforms the scaling of the numbers. So in the linear series which we are using here, it is like from 1 to 2. It's unit changes that are in question. But in the log series, it's about percentages. So it's a different perspective into the numbers, so to say. So let's start test our stock market at VIX index data, and here. So let's go through the command. We first hit unit root. Dicky Fuller is our test DF, and here is the DF data, and specify the VIX column there in data, and then we're using drift, allowing drift to be in our series, and first we are only using one lag. So let's run the test. So in the unit root test, the null hypothesis is that there is a unit root. So the thing is, in this case, we would write our null hypothesis in this way. That's a null hypothesis, and R calculates two different test statistics here. The first one is the basic unit root test, and in this case, I've written here where these numbers refer to, and here we are using only this option. So here, tau 2 refers to the unit root test with intercept, and phi 1 refers to the unit root test, refers to the case that there's a unit root and no drift. So in a case, when you have significant intercept in the unit root test, it means that the intercept is causing stochastic behavior in time series. Randomness is coming from there. So then these are the statistics, and then we have to compare these values with our probability distribution values, and these are the three different thresholds given. So here we'll see immediately that almost value 5 exceeds the value of 1, that refers that null is rejected strongly. So in this case, we have a stationary series. In the second case, our test statistics, 12 exceeds 6 quite strongly, referring also to the stationarity. But we used only one lag, so let's next test what does the lag with the, what's the result with 5 lags is. And when we add lags, our null hypothesis is that there is a unit root. We'll get this value. We'll see that minus 3.3 is somewhere between 1 and 5%. So we have a stationarity, although it's not strong, just stationary. Here I've actually written something about, I could have said this also earlier. So we have a Wix series. So Wix is about the standard deviation for the options in 30-day forward window. So it's a outlook for futures, how market are seeing what the future, the next 30 days will be. So due to its forward-looking nature, it's a risk measure. So that was just an economic, some economics for the Wix index. And here we could additionally test just the differences of the Wix. So we always, when we're testing unit root, we're always just testing the differences. Either in the case of linear scaling like here, or in log scaling, then it's still the difference between the log values. Is always just the difference and not the relative change. So just for the sake of fun, we could run this difference test. So if we take the difference of the series, we get even higher test statistics than earlier, and we look at the 1% threshold, they are exceeding quite nicely. But that test isn't needed, because if our level series is stationary, then it would be something really strange if our difference wouldn't be stationary. Then there would be something really strong in the series. Really strange. So next, let's do the unit root test for the European aggregate stock market. First, we are using one lag. Now, when we compare this statistic with threshold values, we see that both of them are below the tension limit. So when our null hypothesis is that there is a truth and the null stays in power, then there really then it strengthens the makes the assumption stronger that there is a unit truth in the series. And then with 5 lags, even though we added some lags, the result doesn't change. Take the values of the statistic and compare them with the threshold of the set. And just as a reminder, the 5% is the critical limit, but in this case, the values are lower than 10%. But next, let's differentiate our series to see if there's a change. When we take the difference of the stock indices, we might test the stats values. Based on the critical values, we'll see that these stats exceed the critical limit of 1%, referring to high stationarity. Strongly supports the assumption of stationarity. And even though if we add some lags, the result doesn't change. We have a stationarity. Then next, let's do the same for the US stock markets. The null is unit root. Then we look at the statistics with 1 lag case. These both values are lower than even the 10% critical values. So the null stays in power, referring to the unit root. Then we'll add some lags, 5 lags, and see is there any change. And in both cases, oh, here's a little mixed result. In the first cases, we see the value of 2.2 is below the 10%. So this refers that. So in this case, there.
According to your own preferences. And then some guidelines for the guidance. Is related to the teamwork project in general? That's where the code schemes will help you.
I'm afraid I have a little problem hearing your voice. I didn't hear you what you were talking about, but could you please try that in that way that type your question in the chat and Alexandra will look at that. Is that?
Yeah, please use the chat.
So I'm sorry, I just couldn't hear the voice. So with 5 lags, okay, this was the case. So in the second case, our test stat is higher than the critical threshold value. And this would suggest that we have a stationarity at 5% level. But here, a V1 value is unit root and no drift. So that suggests that yeah, there's a unit root, but no drift. So stochastic behavior is not coming from the intercept. But then let's differentiate our stock series and use 1 lag. In both cases, our test stats values are high and higher than the critical, even the critical 1% thresholds. So in this case, we have a stationarity. With 5 lags, the result is the same, stays the same. It also supports the assumption of the stationarity. So the next part, okay, next we'll start to use the information criteria to decide the optimal lag structure. So first, this is the same test as earlier, but now we are using the information criteria to specify the optimal lag for the test. So the information criteria in this case chooses 1 lag, since 1 lag is optimal in testing the unit root. And in both cases, in the big series, we have a test statistic that is higher than the critical values, even 1%. So this refers to the stationarity or supports the stationarity. Next, let's test same letting the Akaike choose the optimal lag, and let's see what the Euro stocks say. In both cases, our test statistics are rather small, even below the critical limit of 10%. So this refers that there's a unit root in the series. We can check the intercept. So at level of 5%, stochastic behavior is coming from the intercept. Okay, that was for the level. Then secondly, into the unit root being in the series, then we'll take the difference and see whether the results change. And now in this case, we get pretty high values, even higher than the threshold, all the threshold values referring to seasonality in the series. Then in the P part, we're applying a little bit different unit root test. So here, the first one was Stigler, here from Phillips Perron test. So how do this, what's the difference between these tests? So Phillips Perron is a generalization of the Dickey-Fuller test, but it doesn't make as strict assumptions about the distributions of the errors than the Dickey-Fuller test. And here the difference is that if there's an autocorrelation in the series, Phillips Perron corrects this in a sense that it ignores the autocorrelation, meaning that the effect of the autocorrelation is not causing the problems in the unit root test. And this autocorrelation could be induced, for example, if there are some omitted variables. So again, unit root test. Earlier it was DF, now it is PP, so Phillips Perron, and then we specify the series in question, test statistics, and let's see what does it say with one lag. Earlier we had a result with augmented Dickey-Fuller that the series was stationary. Here again, that's our test statistics. And then we compare these statistics with the critical values, and we see that it exceeds them. And then with 5 lakhs, test statistics value is higher than the critical. And when the null is rejected, this supports the assumption of the stationarity in the series. The Phillips Perron for Euro stocks, 5 lakhs. Compare the test statistics with the critical value, we'll see that there's a unit root. With 5 lakhs, unit root. Then we're taking difference of the Euro series with 1 lakh. Compare test statistic with the critical values. This refers when it exceeds, it's about stationarity, and now it is about stationarity. And with 5 lakhs, it's about stationarity again. And then quickly, the US stocks. I'll just read the results. First, Phillips Perron, 1 lakh unit root, 5 lakhs unit root, difference the series, 1 lakh stationarity. 5 lakhs stationarity. So our result is that although we ignored the outer correlation, we got the same results. So Wix is stationary at the levels, at the level of the levels, so to say, without taking any changes, but the stocks are stationary in returns. Then there's some, then there's a mention about the third possible test about the unit root, but I can't remember what was the name of the test. The main idea is that you should be familiar with the assumptions of the unit root test, so you know what you're testing. And in some cases, it could be, well be the case that you should look some third test.
Yeah, I think for the third test is KPSS test, right?
Yes. Can you write that down into the chat, please?
Yeah.
Yes, thank you.
Third.
Yeah, that's idea of that test is that the null hypothesis is the opposite, like in the Dickey-Fuller case. So in that case, the null is that the null test the stationarity. So meaning that if the null is rejected, then there's a unit root. So it's just done the opposite way. Then our sixth question, testing the unit root in the interest rate data.
Before you go to the sixth question, I just want to say that in Stata, like all the Dickey-Fuller and Phillips-Ron and KPSS tests are possible, and they work in the same, like they're calculated in the same way as R calculates them. But the only thing that in Stata, there is no option of automatic clock selection. So the way out of this issue is just like to start with the first clock and then to manually go through higher order clocks. Yep. And also for the Dickey-Fuller test, the critical values in Stata are interpolated, meaning that I found Stata less strict in identifying unit roots, and this means that sometimes when R is saying that there is unit root, the Stata will say that the series are stationary. So yeah, these are the main differences.
Yes. And then our sixth question, so libraries and then the data. And this last question, okay, it starts. Something seems to be wrong. So let's see if that sometimes just R causes these weird errors. Yeah, it seems to be the case that there's nothing wrong with the data should work. So let's continue. So we want to test whether there's a unit root in the spread, spread referring here the difference between the 10-year and 3-month interest rate. So the spread is already calculated in the data, so we'll just beginning testing it. And yeah, this is just testing the whole exercise about testing the unit root. So first, let's let Akaike select the optimal lag and let's check whether the difference b- between the 10-year interest rate and 3-month interest rate is stationary or there's a unit root. Our null is that there's a unit root. Look at the test statistics. These are the values. Then compare them to the critical values. So in the both cases, our test supports the assumption that there's a unit root in the series. Secondly, we test use same thing without the optimal lax selection or not the Akaike optimal lax, but just use the 12 lax. And here in this case, we'll see that these both test statistics fall between the value of 1 and 5%. So we have a stationary series at the level of 5%. Yeah, still we have a we don't have that strong result, and we look at the intercept. So we can see from the intercept that it is most probably the case that the intercept is causing some stochastic behavior in series. So that was the A part, then the B part. So first one was for the spread and then the long-term rates. And let's check the unit root. The null is there is a unit root. These are the statistics. And then compare these values to the critical values in the both cases there below, referring to the case of unit root. In the C part, it's about TPLs, short-term rates. Let's check whether there's a unit root. Both cases, the test statistics fall below even the 10% value, so this refers that there's a unit root. So the first three parts were fairly quick. Then there's the D part. So this is more about explaining what are the, so how it is possible the individual rate act as a unit root processes, whereas the spread might be as a stationary or non-stationary process. What's the economic interpretation in each case, and in which form should the spread be utilized for further analysis? So if we look at the spread tests, the interrelationship between these two series. So the series necessary condition for the co-integration of two series is that both of these series have a unit root. But even though the both series have unit root, it could well be the case that their interrelationship is spurious and not that, meaning that unit root of this in this both series cause a stochastic trend that looks as if the series were interconnected even though they are not. If this is the case, try running normal regression and see whether the R squared value coefficient of the determination value is high, and if this is significant, and then test the autocorrelation of the residuals, and when the residuals are strongly autocorrelated with this criteria, it can very well be the case that the interrelationship between the series is spurious and they are not really co-integrated. But if they are co-integrated, this means, and this can be tested, and we will be testing the co-integration next week. So if the series are co-integrated, this means that there's a long run dependency between the variables, so that both of these variables share a common stochastic trend, meaning that they're reverting around the same rent. They're intersecting, although the series are differing, going sometimes further away from each other. They're, after a while, they're intertwine again and cross each other. So this can be, if this is the case, this means that the linear combination of these two series, in this case, one referring to the UT and here the other one is just its difference with the XT, this linear combination should be E zero series, meaning that it is stationary. And in the E part, the last part, we are doing this same test for the subsample. So first, let's collect subsamples specified there. First, spread of our subsample, let's test that, letting Akaike choose the optimal lag. The null is unit root. Look at the test statistics. Both are rather small. Compare them to critical values below, and you'll see that both fall below even the 10% limit. So null stays in power. There is a unit root. Secondly, let's use 12 lakhs. And the result is the same. There's a unit root in the test. And thirdly, now we are testing the long run interest rate in our subsample, if there's a unit root. The null unit root, compare the values in both cases. The null stays in power. There's a unit root. And lastly, we'll check the unit root in the subsample of the T-bills. And here our result is a bit mixed. So taking these values, in the first cases, tau 2 value here, it's a little bit higher than the critical 5% value, referring to the stationarity at the level of 5%. And yeah, then the second value is a little bit lower than the 5% threshold, meaning that it's almost stationary at the level of 5%. So in this last case, we could this gives us some support for the assumption that the series is stationary. So this was everything I had. Do you, Alexandra, want to show something?
Not really. Like, I think we've covered everything.
So that was everything this week. I hope you have a nice week and your lectures continue on Wednesday. So see you again next week.